Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of September 12th, 2014. Open up just about any high school yearbook, and some kid is probably quoting Jack Kerouac, saying, "The road is life." Yeah, you can get pretty cliched pretty fast when you start talking about journeys and destinations and what it means to be on the road. But traveling, discovery, and the perspective that comes with them still exert a pull over us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with your everyday life. We're coming to you from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting because we took the show on the road this week to Portland. We've got a show about both what we found here and some more metaphorical journeys, like moving from independence to old age. You can always share your road wisdom, literal and figurative, on MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
Good news for workers in California. Governor Brown has signed a landmark bill that gives all workers paid sick leave.
Fed Governor Daniel Tarillo will reportedly announce today that the Federal Reserve is planning to implement risk-based standards for large banks that are even higher than international standards.
Apple CEO Tim Cook unveiled what he called the most personal device Apple has ever created, the new Apple Watch.
McDonald's filed to trademark the term McBrunch.
Well, we do a segment on this show called Just Regular Old Brunch. We're going to talk about Apple and lots more. Plus, we're in Portland this week, so let's eat. We are out having brunch in Portland, Oregon. We are at Tasty and Alder, and I've got with me Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine and Ben Walsh from the Huffington Post. Welcome to both of you guys.
Hi.
Hi, good to see you.
Should we just get a bunch of things, or do you guys want to get individual things?
I want my own biscuit.
All right, okay. Fine. I want to start with the big news rollout, or I guess we can call it a sales rollout, right? All of the Apple products, the new iPhones, the iWatch, and then the appearance of U2.
The rollout of Bono.
The rollout of Bono.
Right.
Apparently the $100 million rollout of U2. This is a fascinating marketing partnership.
It's really bizarre, and they're a total rarity in the music industry because they actually make money selling music, which is not something that most bands make money doing these days.
So you think they should have given up that slot to a band that doesn't make money?
Yeah, find someone who needs the
right.
Needs the income.
Yeah. Needs the income.
U2 is not hurting.
Bono does not need another.
No.
What'll be interesting, and what they didn't really talk about yesterday, was the acquisition of Beats by Dre and the fact that Apple is in the music business now. It could be like they function almost like a label, and they promote these artists that are kind of their artists. They subsidize the creation of music the way that they did with U2.
Let's talk about the new iPhones and the iWatch. The iWatch seemed to capture a lot of people's attention. I guess the question is, what is it? Is it a watch? Is it a tiny computer on your wrist? Is it some weird Dick Tracy fantasy? Are people going to buy this thing?
It's definitely not the weird Dick Tracy fantasy, which I think people wanted. So it doesn't really... All the features of, like, showing you text messages and... They only really work when the phone is on your body. So when the phone is not near you, those things don't work.
And the watch only works with an iPhone.
Of course, yeah.
I think this is like every other Apple thing where it is the first iteration of something that will become cool, but now is not the time that people are going to buy it.
Apple is retiring the original iPod.
It's actually sort of funny, like, that Apple brought out a watch when they killed watches by bringing out the phone, and they brought out U2 when they killed music by...
Yeah.
there's like the life of that's like a little mayfly, but, you know, engineered.
I find the killing of the iPod to be Apple's getting out of the hard drive business, which is sort of...
How so?
Well, because the storage on an iPod is insane. It's been kind of quietly and behind the scenes been going up and up and up for years and is now, you know, multiple times what you can get on an iPhone. But people just don't need that much storage anymore.
I bet like 10 years from now you're going to see guys walking around with big original iPods the way that they do with boomboxes right now.
That it will be reclaimed as a vintage
Yeah,
thing.
They'll just be like this cool thing. Like, check out my huge iPod.
What do you think?
Sure.
You're right there.
Wow. That looks yummy. I want to talk about a big public shift that we have seen in the past year, the past couple of years, which is public opinion about banks. Gallup came out with this poll that showed that Americans now have a positive view of the banking industry. What? When? How did that happen?
I mean, part of it is that from 2008 to 2009, public opinion of banks could hardly have gotten worse. There have been scandals, but they've been kind of complex, and they haven't caused a global financial crisis. There's been LIBOR, which
these
most
are hard to explain, hard to understand.
Yeah, and they really haven't hit home to the real economy in the way that the financial crisis did.
I disagree with that. I think people hear, you know, this bank is paying, you know, $28 billion for mortgage fraud. They see that headline. They know. I think
of course.
They just don't care anymore. I don't really buy that.
I'm still surprised because the opinion of banks has moved almost 20 points in the past year. That's a lot.
But I think that it also plays into the fact that Americans are kind of predisposed to have good feelings towards corporations generally. You look at the approval ratings of companies that are in industries like, you know, pharmaceuticals or like big agribusiness that have like, you know, legitimate complaints about the way those businesses impact our lives, and Americans don't have any problem with them.
All right, here's one that I think is an interesting demographic shift that's going to change the way we live. There are now more single people than married people. That is a huge shift from the post-World War II concept of, you know, nuclear family, stable marriage, even things we have written into our tax code to promote marriage.
A couple of months ago, there was this really interesting study that this economist Justin Wolfers pointed to that basically said that, like, people are getting married later in life, which everyone kind of feels and knows, and the data backs it up. But what he said is that even though people are getting married later in life, they're spending basically the same proportion of their lived lives married.
Because we're aging?
Because as life expectancy gets longer, basically people are pushing off getting married at a proportional rate.
Huh.
And so we're spending about the same amount of time on aggregate married, even though we're getting married later in life, because we're living longer. When people get married and when people move in together, that's a huge economic boost. The economists refer to it as household formation, and basically, like, forming a new household is thousands of dollars of spending over the course of a year.
Okay. All right, we've got food. Right. Let's
anybody want bacon? Bacon
that
salad?
Has bacon, which looks amazing.
I also have this gigantic spoon, which...
You do. It's like a comically large
basically
spoon.
Basically a spatula.
Oh, wait, I don't think I have a fork.
Oh,
no, I do.
How about this one? Iconic American toy being eclipsed by a plastic block. Barbie... Barbie is now less popular than Lego. More kids are playing with Legos.
I think that's fantastic. Legos are a great toy for kids. They make you think creatively. They make you think. Barbie is laden with all kinds of potentially detrimental.
Oh, I think Barbie would disagree with that. They've been trying to make her president for a long time. She's been, like, in combat. She's done a lot of things.
Barbie has been cycling through every stage of the American economy. But my mother is an early childhood expert, though, and I would be remiss if I didn't focus on the idea of Barbie as, you know, free play where kids can imagine other things. You can start to imagine grown-ups, and you can start to imagine the roles that grown-ups fill. I'm not sure that I would imagine a grown-up with an 18-inch waist. But there's, I don't know, there's some interesting stuff in there. I think probably on the whole, for women, it's a good thing.
What happened to Brat?
This has been a wonderful brunch. A special thanks to Tasty and Alder for hosting us here in Portland. Ben Walsh from The Huffington Post and Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, did I need to try the biscuit?
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. We've been talking about Apple's new iPhone and watch. Tech companies like Apple and Samsung like to make you think the newest technology can change your life. So, can it? We sent Marketplace Weekend producer Jenny Ament out in downtown Los Angeles to find out how technology is actually changing lives.
Can I ask you a couple of questions for Marketplace Weekend?
Sure. My name's Connor Kirby, and I'm from Orange County. I find myself on my phone constantly, whether it's fantasy football, Facebook, Instagram, the usual.
My name is Dorian Jones, and I'm a resident here in Los Angeles. I closed my Facebook account. I realized that people, we automatically are designed to be able to communicate with each other. And technology kind of severs that tether between. And so therefore, I just kind of cut myself off from it.
My name is Zachary Burge.
And how has technology changed your life?
Well, technology has influenced my life a lot. Well, when I was born, I had like a collapsed lung. So like the first 3-4 months of my life, technology kept me alive until I could get enough like steroids in my body to make my lung grow.
My name is Rosette Malkin. Technology involves every day of my life. I just use it constantly, every second. And yeah, I love technology.
Sure. My name is Alfonso Santiago. Oh, wow. How? I used to remember a lot of things easier. For example, like just phone numbers. I don't even know my mom's phone number because I have it on my phone.
My name is Manuel. Skype, FaceTime. Used to be drive to somebody's house to see them. Now you can just see them and speak. You don't have to drive over there. Well, life gets more faster.
Hi, my name is Brett Barnes. An example of the way it's changed my life is I'm wearing a Fitbit, okay? So my Fitbit monitors how many steps I take. It is keeping me a track of my health for me, and it makes me think about it more often, and that's improving my quality of life. I've lost weight because of my Fitbit. I'm exercising more because of my Fitbit, and that's, you know, where technology has definitely benefited me because it helped me to track that information, and I'm benefiting from that.
Later on the show, if I spend one more dollar on this car...
I'd gotten towed like twice in like a 2-month period, and I was dealing with insurance and I got a flat tire, and having a car was just a huge financial liability.
Give it up. Go car free. Could you? That's coming up. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We've been here in Portland, Oregon all week. Outsiders might know the city from its caricature on the comedy series Portlandia, or picture great coffee, upscale restaurants, and a downtown boom. But underneath that, Portland's wrestling with something a lot of cities face when they grow: how to stay an affordable place to live. What's different here is the law. Oregon is one of two states that doesn't require developers to set aside affordable housing when they build. We took a trip to the east side of the city to put this all in context. It was a sunny but windy morning, and we asked affordable housing advocate Vivian Satterfield to show us around.
Describe kind of the neighborhood where we are, because we're looking at a lot of little kind of, I would say, bungalows, single-family homes, and then here we've got an apartment building coming up.
It's interesting because right across the street we have what looks sort of be a mixed development. There's some retail and ground floor development here, and then looks like to be residents all above, but mostly it's a residential neighborhood.
This is a little bit of a story, this building. I mean, this is the story that we're talking about. If you build a building like this in Portland, you don't have to set aside a portion of your units for affordable housing.
Well, it's not mandated at all. So what we have are voluntary incentives under what's called voluntary inclusionary zoning, which the really basic level just means if you want to build a new development, the city will give you, as a developer, a whole host of incentives to actually build in affordable units, anything that's not market rate.
Now, it got pretty windy at this point, so we ducked back into Satterfield's office. She is the associate director of OPAL, a local advocacy group.
We don't have the mandate, that tool at our disposal, inclusionary zoning, because of a 1999 ban. We share that distinction with Texas, only two states. It's really a tale of two cities. What we have is what some of our members and constituents call a rich person's playground in Portland, and then really the working class and the people who are here to make the coffee and fold the sheets and drive the buses, they're being pushed farther and farther out to the edges of the city, which actually was only annexed recently from the 1980s. So lack of sidewalks, lack of green space, poor connectivity, and virtually no transit service. Those are where those folks are being pushed out to.
Why is that happening?
It's happening because the inner core of the city is being developed at such a rapid rate, and because we don't have a mandate to force developers to include non-market rate apartments, therefore affordable housing, the market just plays out. And, you know, the top dollar gets to buy the top places to live in Portland.
Can't you make the argument, though, that money and capital coming into a city increases its tax base, increases its ability to provide services for all of its citizens?
You could, but there's also a lot of economic inefficiencies by having your workforce being at the very edge of the city. These folks are traveling over an hour on public transit and linking their transit trips together in order to go to their jobs. That's not only bad for our economy, it's bad for our environment.
A lot of this seems to be the conversation you have about gentrification all over the country. Is there something that you think makes Portland different?
You know, there's this Portland mentality of wanting to be authentic, wanting to do it yourself, wanting to identify with the working class, but then not really wanting to live by working class people. So I think that the, you know, the creative sort of we can do it ourselves, we can make it kitschy is actually coming at a cost.
Tell me how you've seen that cost show up.
I've seen that cost show up in the type of people who are being displaced and having to move. My first 4 years here in Portland, I moved three times as a renter. That's an economic cost for individuals, economic cost for the entire city when folks don't have stable places to live. They're continually moving their kids in and out of schools and relocating their entire lives in such a short period of time.
Vivian Satterfield, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Lizzie. I appreciate it.
We reached out to various developers and industry groups all week long to hear their side of the story and didn't hear back from them. But in the past, they've argued against proposed laws to include affordable housing requirements. John Chandler, the CEO of the Oregon Home Builders Association, spoke recently with the Oregonian newspaper, saying that he didn't think politicians here were invested in changing the law. He said they're very serious about being seen fixing it, but they don't get serious about actually doing it. There's another view in Portland, which is 76% white, that a lot of this is about race.
It was really hard for me to come to grips with the history that we have here in terms of race.
That's Cameron Witten. He's a community activist here.
Even now, you're looking at the Portlandia image. You're
right.
Looking about how I'm a sober cycling vegan. And there is that image that people come here for, they hear about, they visit, they move. And that's celebrated, that's lifted up. And at the same time, I've personally seen erasure, like actual invisibility and silence of these communities that have been marginalized, who have identities that have not been celebrated in the same way that we've celebrated all these other things about Portland.
You can laugh at me, but, you know, I do look from the East Coast vantage point and I think, oh, yeah, Portland, that's you know, plaid shirts and coffee and bicycles. And it does have this kind of idyllic Pacific Northwest image. And a lot of the stuff you're telling me undercuts that.
Yeah.
Why do you think people outside of this area don't know that story?
I like to say there's two reasons. One is Portland is the major white city in America. There is no other city of this size that is as homogenous as this area. And so I think it's very easy for people who have been marginalized to be silenced because we are still a huge minority in this population. The other issue really is a marketing, a cultural issue. And I like to bring up Portlandia a bunch. I know a lot of friends who act in that, and that's lovely to see. But people move to Portland. They come to visit Portland, and they really come with the expectation or the assumption that it's one big Saturday market where we bike around naked everywhere and we raise goats. And it's really hard to combat that because there is no financial incentive for us to be talking about the fact that people live here and they find it harder and harder to get by.
Oregon is only one of two states in the country that doesn't mandate including affordable housing. You know, when you build, how do you organize people to do that? It has failed and failed again here.
Yeah, it's super tragic. We currently, as a community, haven't prioritized how do we have inclusive affordable housing. Like, that needs to be a big issue. Rents went up 6% last year. That's not something everybody knows. Like, we aren't watching that the way we need to. So we really need to create a movement that involves the community and also is targeted to working with our decision makers in order to get this repeal to happen.
Cameron Witten, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
And that brings us to the weekend number. It's 239. That's how many dollars, on average, it takes to buy 1 square foot of housing in Portland. That's according to Zillow. The online real estate listing company says the average price of a home here is $299,000. That's up almost 7% since this time last year. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. Here's a story about changing your perspective on the road. America is a car country. We love them, we rely on them, until sometimes we dump them. Kyle Hill is a tech entrepreneur in Los Angeles who broke up with his car.
I've owned a car for most of my life. I had a car growing up. I got a car when I was 16 years old, and my dad was a mechanic. I'd gotten towed like twice in like a 2 month period, and I was dealing with insurance and I got a flat tire, and having a car was just a huge financial liability. With the kind of influx of all these ride sharing programs with Uber and Lyft and Sidecar and Get Around where you can rent your car, I started to do the math for myself and say, you know what? I think there's a crossover point. I believe there's a crossover point where it does make sense to only use ride sharing or bike to work and use other modes of transportation, not own a car. It was becoming such a pain to have that car. So I finally just sold it. And I recently wrote a financial model on my blog that compared car ownership with UberX, specifically in Los Angeles. Ironically, they're the market that's most reliant on cars, but it's also Uber's biggest market. You're going to spend 6, 7, 8 hours in a car in a week. And this is time that you're not being productive. You're not working. You're not thinking. You're not being creative. So one of the variables in the model, which a lot of people were kind of surprised that I even added, was the opportunity cost of your time. The cost ownership in a year I had was essentially a function of fuel, interest on the car, your insurance costs, your repairs costs, your taxes, parking fees that you're going to incur in a year, any tickets that you get, and then what we just discussed, the opportunity cost. So it's a pretty simple model. I think the biggest input is going to be miles driven per year. Just kind of fast forwarding to the end, I mean, I found this crossover point around 9,000 miles. And you can say the average American will drive about 14,000 miles in a year. And so, unfortunately, for the average American, this doesn't make sense. You can't just ditch your car. But if you drive 9,000 miles or less, it does make sense to actually swap your car for these ride-sharing programs. What I've found personally is that when you don't have a car, you become more resourceful with rides. You know, you walk places you didn't think you could walk, and you don't become as reliant on this giant metal financial obligation. And I really like the fact that I had completely eliminated the possibility that I could ever have any more interactions with police in a motor vehicle. That was such a freeing thing for me to just know that I'll never have to deal with a DUI. I'll never have to deal with speeding tickets or being racially profiled. And, you know, when you get out to some rural areas, there is still prejudice still happens when you get pulled over. And I've been treated very rudely and had a lot of disrespect from a lot of the police. And I hate that. It's the lowest that I've ever felt as a human being when I'm pulled over and I have to succumb to this person who has so much authority and power over me. And it doesn't matter what they pulled you over for. It was very liberating for me to get in the back seat of a car and not be the driver and not have to carry this fear for police. And it's really changed my mentality around the police officers in the last 3 years. When I see police, I don't get this anxious feeling anymore. It's a little more liberating. So it's not just young black males. I think it's anybody that doesn't want to be bothered by the police. To eliminate all of those risks is a really nice feeling. I've actually asked the Uber drivers what my rating is, and it's around 4.7.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Have you ever borrowed a book from thousands of miles away? Or sent someone a fax from the beach? You will.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So we're doing something a little bit different this week. We're not trying out technology in real life together. You are at an event in San Francisco called TechCrunch Disrupt, sort of part marketing party, popularity contest, but also a place where venture capitalists look to put their money behind the future of tech, the next big thing, if you will.
Yes, that's right. It's going on this week in San Francisco. I'm here at Pier 48 in downtown San Francisco all week, close to the Giants baseball stadium and the Bay Bridge. I'm at this sort of giant building that's full of startups. They all have their little booths set up with materials and information. It's almost, you know, like a middle school science fair. There are startup battles that take place. You can win prizes. You can actually, I think the grand prize is $50,000.
Wow.
Most importantly, though, you know, you can get some extra visibility at an event like this.
So what kind of startups are you seeing this year?
Well, a lot of different kinds, actually. I've seen startups that use virtual reality headsets, like the Oculus headset that you've probably seen or heard of. I've seen a startup called Gem that promises to help app developers and small businesses use and pay each other with Bitcoin more easily, securely. I saw one from Israel called Is It You, which is actually designed to help companies deal with their customers through facial recognition by turning your phone into this sort of like face scanning device. Lots of stuff.
You're saying businesses and companies a lot. It sounds like you and I are not the intended audiences for these companies.
Well, you're right. There's actually definitely something happening in the startup world in that it's evolving. I ran into Don Dodge. He's an advisor to venture capital fund Google Ventures. He's been at every Disrupt event since the beginning, about 8 years ago, and has watched it change.
But I think the difference is now that startups come to these events to find business partners or to find the first kind of partnerships or integration with other bigger applications. Whereas in the past, they were all about audience and traction and building user base. It's not about building user bases anymore. It's about finding paying customers.
Now, those paying customers aren't you and me, Lizzie. They're businesses and merchants. And in a way, that's a reflection of what you and me actually want or don't want. There was new data from digital analytics firm Comscore last month saying that the majority of smartphone users these days in the States are downloading zero new applications onto their smartphones each month.
So if these new companies aren't targeting me, why do I care about what they're trying to sell to some other big business?
It's a good question. You might not yet. But what I think you're going to see, Lizzie, in the next few years is changes in the applications you use at work. A huge number of startups are trying to make software you use every day at work or remake software that you use every day at work, from email to expense reports to other stuff. They're trying to make this stuff better and more mobile in some cases, and also more social. And while the idea of this stuff at the moment might make you want to claw your eyes out, a social network for your, you know, expense reports, eventually, hopefully, this stuff will make our lives easier as employees and as small business owners, etc. And that could be a good thing.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. You can download the Marketplace app on Google Play or get it in the iTunes store. Later in the show, the delicate balance between go-getter and almost stalker.
And I start inundating this company with emails. I call them a few times, just get nothing. I get machines. I leave messages. I'm probably getting on that like borderline of like weirdo.
That's coming up after the break. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. This week, we asked our community, both listeners and online, to think about a really tough topic, both emotionally and financially. Planning and caring for an aging relative. It's a metaphorical journey and can be painful. One of you wrote in about feeling frustrated, even guilty, saying, "I didn't think it would be so hard." We took what you had to say to an elder law expert based here in Portland, and we visited him in his office.
I'm Garvin Ryder. I'm an attorney, and I'm a specialist in elder law. I've been practicing elder law exclusively for about 17 years, and I'm this thing called a certified elder law attorney, which is somebody who specializes in elder law and has done so for 10 years.
I want to play a clip from a listener who wrote into us about this. Her name is Amy, so I want to listen to what she had to say.
Hi, I'm Amy from Cincinnati, Ohio. And this is my experience with elder care. So my dad has early onset dementia and is currently living in an independent senior facility. My sister and I would really like to hire a part-time companion to help him with errands and so forth, but it really feels like a gamble since he has limited savings, and of course it's an unknown time horizon. We're really struggling with, should we get him the additional care now, knowing that money will likely run out, or should we put off taking action in an effort to try to preserve those funds for future care?
So it sounds like Amy's in a little bit of a bind and sort of trying to puzzle out what's worth spending the money on now versus, you know, what the future holds.
Well, right now, her father's living in an independent living facility, and the costs are just going to be tremendously cheaper than full-blown long-term care. Independent living means you're not getting assistance with activities of daily living. And anything that you can do to keep him in that level of care as long as possible is going to end up saving the family a lot of money. So I think this is one of those situations where paying to get some additional care to keep him in that level of care now probably is more likely to result in having his money last longer rather than the opposite.
And I would imagine also give him some comfort and peace of mind in being in the same place.
Absolutely. And people want to be in the least restrictive care setting possible. You know, independent living is, it's not quite living at home, but it can be a really vibrant environment. And, you know, that means that you have to be able to take care of things like going to the bathroom by yourself, getting dressed, taking showers, transfers, mobility. And so you do have to be able to live independently. But for most people, that's just their number one goal. And anything that you can do to extend that for your dad, I think would be a great way to go.
I've read some research that shows that women shoulder the biggest burden of care, whether it's a sister in a family, a daughter, a wife.
Well, it's overwhelmingly true as far as my personal experience. I mean, there's a lot of daughters-in-law out there who are really the movers and the shakers and the caregivers.
I think a lot of families initially maybe think the options are home versus nursing home. What else is out there? I feel like there's a much broader spectrum.
Oh, there definitely is. And in Oregon, we have in-home care through our Medicaid program. And of course, for non-Medicaid people, hiring in-home care is a good option. Adult daycare services. And then we have things like adult foster homes, which in Oregon means a home that's got no more than 5 residents. It's in the community. It doesn't look or feel like a care facility. But because there's so few residents, you can get really great care there for a low price. We also have assisted living facilities and memory care facilities that kind of really specialize in Alzheimer's care. And we really only try to get emphasize nursing facility care for people who are at that highest level of care, serious physical impairments, probably in addition to dementia needs.
How early should you have this conversation in a family?
When you're reaching retirement age, that's not a bad time to think about long-term care insurance if you can afford it. And also, a lot of people, when they look for retirement housing options, need to be thinking about what sort of transition there is from independent living to a higher level of care, and whether if they are thinking about some sort of an independent living community, what happens if you need care? What sort of options does the community have? Can you stay inside one community? Are there other options close by? Where do the kids live? You know, are they going to be available to provide support? And a lot of times what happens is the family needs to have a real discussion about who's the most appropriate caregiver. It's important that the older generation get to make those decisions, putting family politics to the side.
Are you seeing a change in the way baby boomers handle things versus, say, people 15, 20 years older than them?
Well, baby boomers are on notice that government benefit programs are not as robust as they may be for an older generation. I think even the older generation has to be on notice about that. But the baby boomers really need to have that, you know, made really clear to them that they're going to be much more on their own, I think, in dealing with long-term care costs and retirement expenses in general, but in particular long-term care costs. The older generation, I mean, we still have a fairly good long-term care program through Medicaid, warts and all. But I think that by the time the boomer generation gets to that point, because of the demographics and the numbers and the costs and all that, there's much less of a social safety net to look forward to.
Garvin Ryder, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure.
Next week, the housing market is making a comeback. We want to know if you're putting your toes in the water. How's the inventory? Can you get a loan? Tell us your experiences in the new normal. Visit MarketplaceWeekend.org or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. You may have heard a series called You Hate My Job on our weekday sister show Marketplace. So we've turned that upside down. So here's the first in our series, You Love My Job. A lot of little kids dream about growing up to work for NASA, to think about or journey to the stars and get paid for it. So what's it like to actually do that? We sent Marketplace Weekend producer Raghu Manavalan to NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab near Pasadena, California, to talk with Bobek Ferdowsi. You might know him as the NASA Mohawk guy. He's a systems analyst who worked on the Mars Curiosity rover and is launching a new mission to Jupiter's moon Europa. And every job, even our fantasy ones, involves getting up and going to work.
I don't know if you remember, what was your first day in the office like?
I remember a few things about my kind of, there's an orientation that you take, you know, the first Monday you come in, and I remember coming, you have to come through the visitor center because you're not, you don't have access to things yet. And I remember, you know, you have to bring some papers, like your, this is my transcripts or whatever proof that, you know, you actually got the degrees that you say you have and things like that. And then them giving you like a little tour of the lab. And I remember going to my desk and the guy who I was going to work with gave me a call and was like, hey, you know, if you have some time right now, just come over to my office. So, you know, I slowly found my way because I didn't know my way around the lab still. And it's a big lab. It's like a small college campus. You know, we have about 5,000 people here. And him going through some kind of review package that they had just put together for review like a month or two earlier, like a mission concept review, essentially saying like, here are the things that this Mars Science Laboratory is going to try to do. And here's, you know, what we think it's going to look like. And here's how it's going to get there. And of course, all that has changed completely since 2003. But that's kind of my first day in a haze. And I remember one particular thing was the lab has two parking lots. One of them fills up pretty early in the morning. And I remember being in a panic every day for 6 months because I didn't realize there was a second parking lot. And I was like, oh, no, what if I show up at 9 a.m. and there's no more spots in this lot? Like, where am I going to go? What am I supposed to do? And so that was kind of my early memories of JPL. It's an odd one to remember, but I remember distinctly.
What's your favorite part about your job?
The people. It's incredibly awesome to work with people who are, you know, so smart, really good people, I would say. Just I feel like there's a lot of good eggs here. And there's something special about working on projects with that group of people, especially because we're so, you know, motivated by a singularity of focus, right? When you think about a mission like a Curiosity or a Europa or all these things that we've done in the past and that we hope to do in the future, there's almost a point at which you realize the only way that this can get done, the only way we can accomplish this is by working together and not kind of being political about the situation. And so even then there's differences and disagreements about, you know, how to approach something, everybody's kind of coming from a good place. And I think that's probably incredibly rare in many circumstances. And it's, I feel so fortunate to be able to work with these people.
What's your least favorite part about your job here?
My least favorite part is probably many people's least favorite part, which is that, you know, we are still often have to work to make these missions happen. The science community and the engineering community would love to do a lot more of these things. We'd like to do them more frequently. You know, I would love to be sending missions all the time to Mars and Europa and Enceladus and all these interesting places in the, you know, in the solar system that we know of and even throughout the universe. And yet we're sort of limited by how much we can do. I want to see all this happen immediately. I want to see the secrets of the universe kind of unfold in my lifetime. And, you know, I have to take a step back and realize these things do take time. And I think most people don't realize how much importance the communication part of an engineering job really requires. And, you know, I think about the things that I end up sometimes spending a little more time on. For example, it's PowerPoint. It's making slides. And people are like, oh, that's your job has that too. And I'm like, yeah, you know, you still have to tell other people what you're doing and try to convince people of a certain approach to something or demonstrate why, you know, one decision is more important, you know, than another. And so that communication skill is a real part of the job that most people don't foresee. I think they think we're always like, you know, just cranking away on things and turning wrenches and stuff like that.
That was NASA's Bobek Ferdowsi. You can follow him on Twitter at TweetsOutLoud and follow us. We're at Marketplace WKND. Has one, a story or a moment when money, or the way you think about it, changed your life. James Ellis's story is about determination. He dropped out of high school, hit the road to New York, and refused to give up, even when some other people might have.
I'd never been to New York. I mean, really, I had Crocodile Dundee. You know, that was like my main New York City reference. I started reaching out to different companies and stuff and getting nothing. I do find this one company called Olive. The work is great. And then there's this little Easter egg on the site, this little small thing, and it says, Axl Rose, click here. And then it's this open letter to Axl Rose. It was this goofy thing, but I saw that and I was like, that's a company that I'm going to get a job at. I stopped looking around for other jobs. I just quit. And I started inundating this company with emails. I call them a few times, just get nothing. I get machines. I leave messages. I'm probably getting on that like borderline of like weirdo status. I'm getting really desperate. Like at this point, like it's full desperation. I'm running out of money. I have so little money that at this point I have sold everything I have. And now I finally decide like I'm going to sell this family heirloom. I had a 1947 Martin acoustic guitar. It belonged to, you know, my grandfather, and he passed it down to me with the strict rule that you are never to sell this guitar ever. And I do not want to fail at this whole moving to New York City thing, you know, especially on the heels of the high school dropout thing. So I decide, you know what, I'm selling it, don't care. That money runs out. I have to find a job. So I write this long letter to Olive. I got to get their attention somehow. I was like, look, I understand if you don't have any jobs, but like I'm just demanding that you meet with me. So I send the letter, radio silence, nothing. Like I'm just checking email all day, like waiting for him to write me back, nothing. Next day, nothing. It's just getting sad. I mean, it's just like, I set myself up so that this is the only place I'm going to get a job. And then, like, these people clearly want nothing to do with me. So at this point, I'm kind of giving up and I'm just applying for anything. And I'm applying for a flower delivery job. And I go on the interview. You know, he's only talking to me for like 5 minutes. And he's just like, yo, just get out of here, man. Just get out. I was like, wait, what's wrong? And he's like, no, I'm not hiring you. Just get out. He's like, I can just tell. Just get out. Don't waste my time anymore. You are going to be out of here in 2 weeks. I can't even get a flower delivery job, and I'm walking back down Second Avenue. You know, I walk by the offices of Olive. I'm walking past the Rutherford Building, and I notice the security guard is kind of off to the side. He's helping like an older woman with some boxes or something. He's kind of carrying them around, and so I just run, and I go to their door and knock on it, and this guy opens the door and hello. And I was like, do we have an appointment? And this is Steve Fritz. This is the person that I bum rushed.
My reaction was, wow, this kid, he comes up here, he dropped out of high school, he's got the attitude, like, I love this guy. And he's smart. And you were telling me the things you were doing, and you'd worked at a printing press, and like I didn't know anything about the press. I was like, wow, he's really smart. I just like him. I like him. I like to talk to him. I could see working around here and smoking cigarettes with this guy. You know, it was almost that simple. What Jay may not have realized at the time is that we were knocking on doors and we were not getting any answers just to make ourselves laugh. We just said, you know what? Let's write Axl Rose a letter. I think this idea was just born out of desperation, and let's see if this guy will ever write us back. And just for the record, he never did. But
a sense of humor, you know, gets you a very long way. And that and the fearlessness that is born out of total desperation, you know, that is a very powerful thing.
You know why that works, though? Is because he was really determined. And he was really hardworking. The one thing I learned in running a business and 20 years of working is that there's a lot of luck involved. You're going to get a lucky chance, but it's what you do with that chance.
The same thing that led me to just run past a security guard and, you know, try to go get a job by sneaking into a building, that same desperation is what made me sell this guitar. It was a point of pride that I was going to somehow figure things out on my own. At the cost of looking like an idiot or being thrown out of a building or losing a family heirloom. And so I think that period of time, those formative years, you know, that definitely shaped everything that followed for me.
by the way, James Ellis is still in New York. He's a partner at the design firm Athletics. And that guitar he sold? Well, when his dad came to visit years later, that 1947 Martin was sitting in the living room like it had never left. He managed to figure that one out, too. Some old place. I've been walking the streets yeah. And And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Special thanks to Oregon Public Broadcasting for hosting us. Next week, we'll tell you what whiskey has to do with Scottish independence. Plus, we'll have some brunch. It's not a bad combination. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Jenny Ament, and John Sepulvedo. Our senior producer is Dan Semitovich. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.